I wanted to open this podcast by reading the American Fishery Society statement from June 3rd, 2020. To be silent is to be complicit. George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor have all been added to the long list of Black victims of racism and inequality in our nation. The American Fishery Society recognizes the pain and anger that people feel in response to these recent events. We stand in solidarity with the Black community against racial biases and injustices, and we support our colleagues, students, and friends that are impacted by these actions. As AFS members, we are connected through our passion for fishes, fishing, and the environment. All spaces should be safe and welcoming to everyone, but unfortunately, we do not all share the same experiences in these settings. AFS rejects discrimination and harassment by any means and currently operates under the recently revised guidelines of the AFS Standards of Professional Conduct. AFS strives for the advancement of equality and inclusion in the fisheries profession and beyond. Every AFS chapter, section, and subunit has the responsibility and power to accomplish these goals. Joining me, I am Julie Vecchio, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com by searching Fisheries Podcast. Our guest today is Bill Rumelot, one of my personal fisheries mentors. Bill is a native of Charleston, South Carolina, and a longtime fisheries biologist for the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources. He received his master's degree at Old Dominion University in 1982, and he worked for the Marine Resources Division of the South Carolina DNR for almost 40 years before retiring in 2013. He was one of the founding members of the Inshore Fisheries Research Group in 1985 with Dr. Charlie Winner, who we tried to get into this conversation to no avail. In 1991, they began using trammel nets to sample the edges of marsh habitats for red drum, spotted sea trout, summer flounder, and other highly valuable inshore fisheries on a monthly basis. The monthly sampling of estuaries along the South Carolina coast continues to this day. While at South Carolina DNR, Bill was the author on 37 publications, including histological identification of spawning, age and growth studies of a wide variety of species, and even the identification of novel parasites and many of the species he collected for decades. He currently teaches in the biology department at the College of Charleston. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
It's really good to be here. I'm interested in keeping fish at the forefront.
It's refreshing to see how many more people are interested in this field. You know, I think it's a field that's continuing and a field that's really exciting for a lot of people. I consider you and Charlie probably the reason that I am in fisheries science to this day, why I've continued to pursue and love fisheries since 2003. So I just wanted to thank you for that. You guys gave me this field. It's amazing.
I have to chime in there and say that I'm really pleased that you continued on after your master's degree from the college, that you continued on for a PhD. That's kind of what we have always been pushing for.
Well, it took me almost 10 years to go back again, but I'm glad that I did. You are actually a native Charlestonian. And I remember actually you telling me once that you had to be a Charlestonian back five generations to be considered local.
to be not considered from off, yeah.
Right, from outside, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that you grew up by the water in the marshes. And what do you think is your earliest memory of sort of loving the ocean and this kind of habitat?
When I was very young, my family owned a cottage up on a freshwater river. So I had an awful lot of freshwater exposure when I was before 10 or so. Right about 10 years old or something, this is something that really stuck in my mind. My father and I went to a local creek because we're all pretty local here. And we were gathering oysters because we were going to have an oyster roast. And I saw this cellophane looking stuff that seemed to be wrapped around oysters. And I'm thinking to myself, this was right about, I don't want to mention it was like the mid 60s or so, but I knew that cellophane was this really cool stuff. And here I was thinking that people were being just trashy and throwing this plastic everywhere in the estuary. And I was miffed. That, I think, got me really interested in marine life. And I was thinking then, and it was obviously, this was Elva that I was looking at, but what it instilled in me was this interest. I was looking closer, more closely at the oysters. I was looking more closely at the fishes that were about the oyster bar. I think that was my first awakening to an interest in things marine.
And then you eventually went for a master's degree studying fisheries.
And I worked with a fellow, Ray Birdsong, up at Old Dominion, who was he was a Gobi guy, an amazing professor. I enjoyed that very much. But what sent me there, as an undergraduate, I worked at the College of Charleston's Marine Field Station, the Grice Marine Lab, the whole time I was undergraduate. It's a great, great spot. When I was in high school, the first director of that marine lab started in like 1965 or something. This guy came in when I was in high school, he gave a one of those career day things, and he talked up marine science to such a degree that I said, that's it. I never looked back. And so I went to the college, got my undergraduate degree in biology with an emphasis on marine, I think it was called. And I had a job immediately with the South Carolina DNR because I had been, as a part of my tasks at the Grice Lab, I was accessing fish into the Grice's field museum, fish museum. And I developed a rapport with the folks at DNR. They offered me a job. As a matter of fact, they had me on one of their, assigned to be on one of their cruises the very day I was supposed to be graduating. And I thought I was going to miss my graduation because I would be out to sea. So I was working as a classification biologist one at the Marine Lab. And I had a little bit of responsibility here and there. Some of the PhDs, a fellow with a bachelor's degree was not worthy of, certainly wasn't worthy of authoring a paper, wasn't worthy of instigating research. And it got to a point, I said, look, I'm going to get nowhere with a bachelor's degree. And I started looking around and found this guy, a friend of the fellow who was my mentor at the college, a fellow named Bill Anderson, a fish guy there. He agreed to take me on as a student, and what a great experience. One of the things that this guy, Norman Chamberlain was the first director of the Marine Lab out there. One of the things he told me, I think it was probably some of the sagest advice I ever got. When I asked if I should try to be admitted into the graduate program at the college, he said, no, don't do it. You already know how we feel about biology. You need to go someplace else and find out what other people think about biology. And that was amazing advice, because when I went to Virginia, Old Dominion, and there was a whole different world, a whole different take on biology that was eye-opening and quite rewarding.
And I think that is really good advice. Personally, I've learned a ton from moving around and doing things at various different places. I think he's spot on. Still, different people have a slightly different take. Learn as many different types of things that you can. You studied gobies in your master's degree?
Well, no. I kind of went into the master's program up there with the idea of what I wanted to do. And I wanted to work with blennies, small fish, you know.
I think most people who aren't specialists would probably like consider them almost the same thing.
Yeah. Even though they're.
Yeah. You know, gobies and blennies.
Yeah. And they're vastly worlds apart, but we won't get into that. And so I did a, I started a systematic review of a certain group of Blennies, and it was, you know, it was really pretty cool. And then I got more into functional morphology and muscle descriptions, South Carolina Department of Mental Resources, for about 18 months before I went back to graduate school. And during that, those 18 months, I developed this appreciation for histology, light microscope study of fish tissues. And it was just sort of a kind of a hobby sort of thing that I enjoyed doing, not part of my job at the time. Well, when I finishing up my master's degree, I was called by the folks at the DNR, at South Carolina DNR. They said, would you like a job? We've got, for my master's work, I did a great deal of histology because that was a lot of fun. And they said, we've got black sea bass here. We don't know much about it. We know that it changes sex. We know that the best way to determine if it changes sex is to look at it histologically. Are you interested in starting something up in that respect? And I said, okay. And that's, and there's thereby started the fish histology at the Marine Lab.
I want to imagine this Blenny. Were you like dissecting them with like tiny little scalpels, cross-sectioning them or what?
Well, I cleared and stained some specimens so that I could kind of see the layout, bones, whatever. And then I took about, I can't remember, four or five individuals, and I serially sectioned them from front to back, cross sections through the body so that I could reconstruct them. Now, you know, there are programs now. A CT scan will do this. Well, this was back before anybody knew how to spell CT. And I was able to correct, there was a little bit of literature on some of the muscle arrangements and some other muscle-bone interactions and even some nerve orientation that I was able to correct because I was able to look at both gross sections of the animals and the histological sections and piece it together. And that was probably, I did this for very solidly for 3 months in my graduate career. I did nothing but eat, sleep, and do this stuff. I can't remember a more satisfying time than that.
Your wife is not a fish person, right?
Oh heck no. No, she's a banker, a retired banker. No, she was very tolerant of me and my, we can call them passions.
Yeah, and she's been tolerant for a long time of you.
Yeah, she has.
Your fish passion.
Yeah, she's gotten used to me doing some pretty strange things.
You invented CT scans with Blennies and and then came back to Charleston and started doing reproductive histology on reef fish.
Yeah, there's a program, the longest running federally sponsored program at the DNR. It's called MARMAP, an acronym for Marine Monitoring, Assessment, and Prediction. It's a federal program that the state has been able to successfully acquire for 30, 40 years because they have very little overhead, or they have less overhead than other folks, and thereby they're able to be granted the contract. So it was very long. Mm-hmm. A long-standing program.
I think that MARMAP actually has partnered with NOAA to really expand the consistency of sampling of the South Atlantic bite, and including some video and other technologies. So you worked in MARMAP for a few years?
When I came back in 78, I started working in MARMAP, and that's when Charlie Winter started working a couple of months, actually for MARMAP, a couple of months before I got there. And Charlie and I found one another, had similar interests in life history, dynamics, and so forth. And he and I essentially have worked together all the way up until 2008 when he retired. We worked together in MARMAP, and then he left MARMAP about 6 months before I did, I can't remember what he was doing then. And I had an opportunity to take my wife was a little impatient with the fact that we'd be gone for 10 days at a stretch, two young children and that sort of stuff. So I took another job that was more lab-based. And then Charlie and I, once again, had similar interests, found one another. And from about 84, like I say, until he retired in 08. We were, he was a PhD, I was a master's guy, and we did some really cool stuff.
That's when you started the inshore fisheries group.
Right.
The stated purpose of that was to keep track of the populations of sport fish.
Because
in the estuary.
There was the Marmot group that was doing stuff offshore, and Marmot knew nothing about estuarine fish, and then so we Charlie and I set up this. It was essentially an estuarine finfish research group, and it started out just him and me, and I think it was him, me, and two graduate students. I would joke that, Jack, you're going to come back and be my boss one day. And he came back and wasn't my boss, but in the mix, he almost took Charlie Winter's position in 08.
You guys were doing like block netting or something?
It was mostly sort of a takeoff on a commercial concept where people would take a net that did not allow certain size fish to leave an area. Mm-hmm. And block it at high tide and just wait for the tide to go away. And then you pick up the fish and sell them or whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, Charlie and I, we did this in a couple of locations thinking that the fishes that we gathered up, and we had big tanks and we'd fill the tanks with water, the tide would go out, we'd capture the fish in these big nets and we'd keep them alive, we'd tag them. And the thought was that once we tagged them in these very discrete locations, that they would spread out and you know, we'd get some idea of angler related mortality of the fishes we were tagging and all the cool stuff you can get from tagging fish, you know, aging, all those other things. And it turned out that the fish we were working with never moved. So that then, after doing that for a few years, and we were also doing some fish toxicant sampling for larval fishes and things, which there were a few more graduate students that were involved in that sort of thing. Well, we decided that since the fish weren't moving, that we would move. And so that initiated the Trimalnet study. And so in 90, we were, once again, fledgling is a good word. In 90, we were trying things out. And then in 91, we officially established the sites that are being used even today. And
there are how many total sites per month that are sampled?
Around
50?
Seven estuaries times six, somewhere between 45 and 50 samples, Trimalnet sets per month, along the estuarine part of the coast. But I like to tell people because, you know, trivia nights, they need some more fodder. Sporobolus, you know about the change there, don't you? The
no.
Sporobolus estuary. Spartina is no longer Spartina. Oh, what a mess. Anyway, and Sporobolus happens to be a desert grass, for God's sake. And those geneticists are at it again. But the Sporobolus alterniflorus marsh occurs essentially from Winyaw Bay unbroken to Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
And what that allows is we have in this part of the world about 1.7 meter amplitude tides in Charleston. It gets up to about 2 meters in Savannah. And there's so much water running in and out of the estuaries, there's no subaquatic vegetation. So we've got all of this Sporobolus alterniflorus marsh that pretty much takes the place of the seagrass that you guys have in Florida, seagrasses they have up in North Carolina.
Is it because the substrate is so mucky?
Well, the reason the substrate's mucky is because we've got lots of silts and clays that suspends in freshwater that precipitates out when it hits saltwater. And also, I mean, not only that, but we've got so much tidal flushing, so much water rushing in and out. And all of the Edisto River is the longest black water river in the United States. And so, yes, there's a great deal of turbulence, but a lot of the turbulence is because we've got these really big tides twice a day that come in and out, and they're by light doesn't penetrate, light can't get to
the
bottom.
Do you want to describe sort of a typical Trimalnet set?
Wow, when we were trying to further our effort at capturing these fish throughout the estuary, as opposed to one place, you know, having them expecting they were spread around. We tried doing this from a outboard, a regular outboard, trying to pay the net off the front of the outboard and things, and found out that as we backed the net around, and you had to do it kind of slowly, and you didn't know where the oysters were, and we have many oyster beds, intertidal oyster beds and so forth. And we found out that as you back the boat around, the engine noise scared any fish away, and so you caught nothing. There were mullet boats around Tampa and the area above Tampa that are Florida net boats. They're exactly the things that we're using. And these
The interesting thing is most of them now don't have their engines in the front anymore. A couple of the old guys do, but most of them don't. It's only only the researchers that do it this way now.
Well, but there was a net ban in the estuaries, and I thought that made them all go away.
Maybe that's why nobody uses that configuration anymore. there are still some amount of net fisheries. It's not the same as it used to be before the net ban. So they'll there's throw net fisheries, but they'll still wrap them. Like they use some sort of blocking net to then.
So the concept here, and you'd have to see a picture of this boat. Maybe you could pull up a picture of the boat.
Yeah.
The engine's up front. And the first boat that we got was a big old heavy clunky thing that was really too heavy. The engine that we had was too small. And so this thing, when we maxed out and we were running really quickly, it would be about 15 knots or so, which was fast enough. Or the net in the back made of monofilament webbing, a trammel net. So there was a layer of large webbing on either side of smaller webbing so that we could use the net in any direction. And as we raced up to the marsh at this full 15 knots, we would enclose an area with this net that was 180 meters long, I think. And it would be, and then we'd do it quickly enough with this 15 knot rapid speed. Now we now do it at about 20 knots. We would then surprise the fish. They wouldn't have opportunity to leave, and we would get a much better idea of the animals that were within this little space that we cordoned off. An important part here is that once we designed how we were going to do this and the protocol of making the set, and this is something I'm pretty proud of, I was there for a number of years to make sure that the protocol was followed pretty carefully so that any change we saw in any of the fish dynamics, whether we had smaller fishes, younger fishes, different growth rates, anything in the fishes that we were capturing wasn't a result of us capturing the fish in a different way, because we were catching them the same way the whole time. So we eliminated a variable, and any dynamic we saw in the fish was much more likely to be a dynamic of the fish growth behavior than it was our differential catching techniques. And that turned out to be a really important factor in making sure you can see the number of animals in an area. You could determine if they were increasing or decreasing. You could determine if the size was being smaller on average. You could look at a whole series of things, because you knew you were catching the fish in the same general area using exactly the same format forever.
A testament to you and the program that it hasn't sort of drifted over time much.
We did push that very much because we wanted to make sure, and that was, and I feel very comfortable about the fact that we were successful at making sure that each of the sets was done as close as possible to the same way as the last.
Yeah. I just want to kind of like run through this quickly because it's probably still one of my favorite methods of sampling. Sampling is always happening on a falling tide so that fish have the impetus to leave the marsh grass and come out.
Exactly.
You have this boat with an outboard toward the front. It's about a third of the way back. It has, and in your case, it has a tiller. You're driving this tiller drive boat, which, by the way, if you're driving a tiller drive boat from the front, you're pointing the tiller in the opposite direction. You think you should be pointing a tiller.
And that gets to be really interesting when I drive my son's John boat.
Right, exactly.
Or at least for a while, because
And these boats are really, really flat, totally flat on the bottom, and combine that with your super mucky, sedimenty bottom, and it's basically water. You can kind of run a little bit through this mud with it.
I have actually taken one of those boats across wet mud, exposed wet mud, and the engine didn't slow down.
And you don't slow your engine down because otherwise you're stuck for the rest of the tide. You get up on a plane on this boat with the outboard in the front, and you run at the edge of the marsh. You throw an anchor into the marsh grass, basically, and then run that same speed until you run out of net, which is 180 meters.
Parallels of the marsh, so that you are then when you come back to the marsh and enclose that bit of water.
Right. And then when you get to the end, it has an anchor on the other end, you throw that into the grass as well. Then you come back around and start picking up that net. And the cool thing about this, the trammel net, is that it's similar to a gill net, except that it's sort of designed to pocket these fish in a way that they just can't get themselves back out.
And hopefully, theoretically, not have them be small enough so that they can gill themselves and damage the gill tissue.
And so they kind of just sit in these pockets until you come back to them, all the while the tide is falling underneath you, and you hope that you have the exact right number of fish to get all the way through your net and get
I can tell
done.
you've done this before. Yeah, all of those things are working at you the whole time. So rarely do you sort of say, "Oh, let's take a coffee break now," because time is one of those critical things in that instance.
Probably my most vivid memory of this sampling was
Cape Romaine.
Cape
Oh,
Romaine,
my
White
favorite
Shoals or
estuaries.
something.
Muddy Bay, I think, is what it's called. But
Okay.
it's interesting in that there really are few rivers that empty into there, and so where you would expect there to be mud, it's a lot of times sand, and the sand could go dry just as quickly as the mud. And if you're on the sand, then you wait for the tide.
Yeah, so we were doing just like, we were like, okay, just one more set. We just have one more site to go. And I think we're going to be able to get back out. No problem. As long as we don't have too many fish. And of course, we hit the set. We got zillions of fish. And the tide was falling. It was, last set before we could get out of there. And we just started like throwing fish into the cooler with the water in it to and not processing them, just like getting them in the boat. And then eventually we got to the point where we just like pulled the net with all the rest of the fish in it and threw it in the back of the boat because we had like minutes to get across the narrow little opening from this little section of Cape Romaine to like to be able to get out that day. I think Erin Levesque was driving, and she just like hit the tiller and just cranked it up and ran as fast as she could across that opening. And once we got to the other side, we were like, "Woo! Okay, we can process our fish now."
Yeah, get them back in the water and then start doing it all over again. Yeah.
Yeah.
That scenario was awfully familiar.
That was the one most vivid instance I particularly remember.
Yeah, I remember a few of those. We never said, "Oh, let's just quit." I mean, because we all had in the back of our minds, this data is going to be used for a myriad of things. Not only will we be tagging fishes and learning from the tagging exercises, but there were a certain number of fishes that we would sacrifice so that we could look at recreational angler mortality as related to the size of year classes. And there were just a series of things.
Having those data out in the world and having those numbers in the world is pretty satisfying.
Your master's work was one of the more appropriately done and necessary pieces of information that has been used critically everywhere.
I should put that in my CV.
Yeah, you really could, because it was something that was necessary. And just this hook-related mortality stuff was nobody had a guess at this stuff until you came in and started doing this. I would when I would catch a red drum and any fish that has a mouth big enough to suck down bait, and the hook was foul hooked, I'd say, "All right, well, I can cut this off. I have seen fishes with the hooks dangling from their after ends, so I'm hoping this is going to help it. Throw the fish over, it swims away, that's great." And your work showed that doesn't always go well. I was of the opinion that once you put them back in the water and they swam away, Oh boy, there they are. They're fine, and not realizing that in a few minutes they could be bleeding internally and become crab bait.
It actually happened a lot less than I thought it would, to be honest. Like, I was expecting a much higher mortality rate with some of the foul hooking than
yeah,
we actually ended up getting.
I was expecting no mortality rate. And you remember the big fish that we necropsied, and the hook was in the heart or in the liver.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, that's just crazy stuff.
Yeah. It had sat there and it had been completely encased. It had been encased in tissue for Lord knows how long.
Right.
And eventually, apparently, this recapture jostled it enough that it broke apart inside the fish and then it bled.
Yeah, there it was.
It was fun and also very humbling because, you know, what I took my project on, I was like, I could learn to fish. How hard is this? Turns out it was really hard.
I wish I were a fisherman, and I humbly say that I'm not. You can ask my grandkids, I'm not. I know where the fish are. I'm not a fisherman.
Switching gears maybe a little bit from, you know, sampling all these fish, it was probably in the early 2000s, you started to team up with the parasitologists and discovering all kinds of new species inside the estuarine fish. Can you tell me a little bit more about that work?
I'll give you a little history there too. Back when I was with the Marmat group, I noticed that we were catching fish offshore, and there were these groupers that had nematodes in their reproductive organs. And I've been a reproductive guy for a long time. And I knew, because I'd been to the college, I kept up with some of the faculty. I knew the parasitologist at the college at the time, a lady named Martha Rooney. And I thought, well, wow, this is such a great deal. We could look at the dynamics of these parasites and stuff. And I took her these specimens, and she said, oh yeah, whatever. Because she was a mouse parasitologist.
And
then, so that kind of went all by the wayside. And then in about 2000 or so, she was replaced by a French lady who was an estuarine fish parasitologist. Zowie, this was something that I thought was just amazing. So I boned up a little bit on some of the parasites that somebody had been contacting me about. I met her at a graduate social, and I started talking about using the name of this parasite. I don't even remember what the heck it was. And she was so impressed that because here's a fish guy, and she doesn't, you know, nobody talks parasites, not in this part of the world. And so what worked out, she obviously was a parasitologist and, lo and behold, a histologist. So she taught both parasitology and histology at the college. I was really interested in histology. I knew a great deal about mammal histology and a lot more about fish histology, tissue types and whatever. And so it was like a marriage made in heaven. We were catching estuarine fish that we would bring back into the laboratory to do our own work. And that was her world from which she could do the other micro dissection, do histological other things, and find parasites that nobody in this part of the country has done much work at all with estuarine fish parasites. There was some work done in Beaufort, North Carolina, but that was back in the beginning of the last century, and nobody's carried on. As a result of us both enjoying the histology and both interested in parasites and the fish, it was a wonderful dozen years or so before I retired that we were able to invite people from various other countries to come in also. Invite them to come in and look at the parasites and different groups of parasites, but to co-author with these people on various dynamics of our fish versus their fish and all sorts of really cool stuff. That was another little jolt, I guess you'd say, to keep me interested in things marine.
And I really love the multiple different uses of these sampled fish.
Oh yeah.
Most of my PhD, pretty much all of my samples came from fish that were being sacrificed for aging growth studies and other types of studies already that were being captured by NOAA and Florida Fish and Wildlife. Just being able to get as many different things out of these specimens as you can is just, it's so great.
It really is. I was the fish guy in these parasite studies. I don't know parasites. One of the cool things that she and I were able to do, Isor Duveron is the French scientist's name, she and I were able to look at histological sections of fish and fish musculature and placement of parasites, and I was able to interpret the fish parts and tell her which muscles and which, wherever, what tissue the parasites were in. She was able to discern the parasites. And the fact that we were able to look at histological sections together and help one another was tantamount to the relationship. It really was cool.
I probably told one of my favorite field sampling stories. Could you possibly pick out one favorite field sampling story?
And I narrowed it down to about 270. I enjoyed doing all of them, so I can't really come down to any one favorite, but what I really enjoyed more than anything else was working with you graduate students and helping you guys tell a story. And a lot of our sampling was sampling, right? We were out there, we're doing this other thing, but we would make extra efforts to answer a question, help the graduate student answer a question.
And with people that were sampling all kinds of different things, and turtles, and I was talking to Virginia Chervet recently.
Oh, Virginia. I've been on a couple of committees. Virginia was concerned that up in the freshwater areas, that the local populace around these freshwater areas were actually consuming gar because they were hungry, right? And so they would, and gar are usually, you know, kind of easy to catch because they're just big lunky things. Anyway, she was interested in the mercury content of the meat. So she had this young lady interested in doing that sort of thing. And we were sampling using an electrofishing boat with which we could go into very low salinities and capture the animals that were there. Many of them were the same animals that we would catch in the trammel nets, but this was their estuarine fish, right? So they were able to live in pretty low salinity in the habitats where we were sampling with the electric boat. So that was, in addition to sampling some of the fishes that we see routinely in the harbor, we would see gar, Lepososteus osseus. We would see those pretty regularly. And so we became the source for this girl's study of mercury in the flesh of this fish. But we said, well, why limit it to the mercury in the flesh? Why don't you? And so we had her do stomach content analysis. She did aging of these silly things somehow. She did reproductive stuff.
Are you working with any marine biology grad students right now?
Yes, I am. I'm not doing any field work with them. They and I are doing histological interpretations primarily of reef fish reproduction. Mm-hmm. Microscopic assessments of maturity stages of spawning frequency, that kind of thing. Well, the two students I was working with, these guys are, Virginia Chevette got some funding that the Virginia Institute of Marine Science gave up and she took over. It has to do with fishery regulations of reef fishes
in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico.
Another of my favorite graduate students, he and I worked a couple species of parrotfish, and it turns out that I'm always learning stuff, right? In tropical waters, the reproductive dynamics, the oocyte size and so forth, is vastly reduced, so that we have spawning occurring when the oocytes are only 500 or 600 micrometers, where in our temperate waters, most of the eggs, I guess, as they respond, were a millimeter or so. So I was learning reproductive biology all over again, essentially. We had to look at various dynamics of the oocytes because size wasn't helping us anymore. Here, this guy was teaching me as I was attempting to teach him. It was just a great experience.
You're also teaching both undergraduate and graduate courses at the College of Charleston?
I am doing undergraduate teaching, yes. I'm a professor down there, and I have taught the fish biology class, a few times. Dr. Duberon went on sabbatic leave. I was asked to teach the histology class for her, which was just a great deal of fun. Even though it's human histology, tissues are tissues, you know?
Parts is parts.
Yeah, they really are. And we haven't invented hardly anything, you know, except that big old lunky thing in our head. We haven't invented any of the physiology or any of that stuff fishes do all the same sort of stuff with the same sort of tissue. But I've been teaching some freshman classes as well. Somebody has reinvented biology since I took it. So I'm having to learn this stuff all over again. And I'm just fascinated by how much cool stuff is out there that we never had an inkling of.
I actually taught high school biology for 3 years. So that was actually a lot of fun. Is there one project out there that you think you might still want to work on? Is there something that you're like, oh, I wish I could have done that and I really still want to?
There is, and it has nothing to do with fieldwork. As much as I really enjoyed being out in the estuary, but my passion was sitting behind a microscope. I thoroughly enjoy making discoveries using histological criteria to tell a story. And we told a pretty good story with spotted sea trout. I'd like to tell a similar story with red drum. We dealt with fecundity. We dealt with different fecundity values by age class and a whole lot of really cool stuff that I would like to be able to do with all of the fish species that we dealt with. In the estuaries, there is no commercial fin fish fishery. Mm-hmm. So all of the stress put on estuarine fish is by recreational angling.
And with red drum too, I'm still constantly struck by how little we know about their adult life history. We know almost nothing about what they do or where they go or how they're acting or anything about them as adults.
If there was something about red drum that was a cure for cancer, there'd be no more questions. But the funding is just not there. The interest maybe is not there, or certainly not critical enough for mm-hmm. people to say, all right, here, take this much funding, do what you need to find out these various answers.
For some reason, it actually has not dawned on me until right this minute that we might be able to use the techniques that I used in my PhD to find out more about adult red drum. So there are larger networks now of ultrasonic arrays, which I think could be another avenue. One of the things that I always like to do when I'm interviewing people for the podcast is to acknowledge that pretty much everybody is not only a scientist, but also has other facets to themselves. You have a family with grown kids and grandkids. And can you tell me a little bit about your grandkids?
I have a son and a daughter. My son has a boy and a girl. My daughter has three boys. My oldest grandson is 14. His daughter's 12. And my daughter's three boys are 10, 7, and 5. The 14-year-old is, my son has sort of a farm. He has about 10 or 12 acres that are just out down the road from where I live, which is very cool. We're real close together. The 14-year-old knows how to drive vehicles. He knows he's got a dirt bike and all this sort of stuff. And what I was really pleased to find out about maybe a month or two ago was that my outboard, I have a small outboard that he was keeping at, he lives on an intertidal creek. And so keeping my small outboard at his dock, the 14-year-old was anxious to be in the boat a lot. And I found that to be so rewarding that I'm trying to promote it. Not only is he going out on the boat, but he's getting a little more sophisticated in developing different fishing techniques. So I think, wow, I didn't push this, but the fact that he has found this interest is just very cool.
I know you used to be really into welding. Do you still do that?
Yes. I finally found enough spare change to buy a very nice, used, but a very nice welding machine that is it's called TIG welding, tungsten inert gas.
What do you make?
When I was, during my career, I seemed to have a lot more time to do welding stuff than I have. No, seriously, since I started teaching, I have been so blasted busy pulling lectures together and I don't feel like I have enough spare time to just fool around with welding. When I was working, what I thoroughly enjoyed doing was making sampling equipment that helped graduate students tell a story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the things that you made was the mounts for my husband Chris's. He was doing the ultrasonic telemetry with sea trout.
Yeah.
And you guys made the mounts for those receivers.
I guess I might be of that particular generation where I never had enough money to call a plumber. And so I had to learn to do it myself. And I've become very comfortable at that sort of modification, repair, small construction, that kind of thing.
if you had free time, would you be doing anything else?
Well, interesting that you should ask, because as a result of the current pandemic, all of the courses at the college are online. Mm-hmm. All summer courses are online, and there's serious talk about having fall courses be all online. Now, I'm an adjunct, and adjuncts are like on the very bottom of the totem pole. And when there is a funding shortage, which is what they're expecting, funding is going to be reduced to where I don't think many of we adjuncts will be. I'm adjusting myself to
having more free time.
Decide what the heck I'm going to do with all this free time. I really don't. I haven't quite gotten myself into deciding what will take up my my efforts, but I haven't thought about it. My wife and I go for walks daily.
Now the tough part of the interview is over, and it's down to my final three questions. So I'll start with my first one. Milton Love once said that you're not a real biologist unless you have a tattoo of your study species somewhere on yourself. Do you have any fish tattoos?
You know how old I am. I do not have a tattoo. Although once upon a time I was working, you may not remember what the heck a rapidograph is. It was a mechanism for we old timers to make labels for putting specimens into jars, and it was indelible ink and so forth. Well, once upon a time I was doing that sort of work, and my wife surprised me. I turned around and I tattooed the inside of her hand.
What is your dream job or location? Would you live anywhere else?
You know, there are places in the world that seem intriguing to me and stuff. I can't think of a better place to live than right here. What I'm sure that I would miss most is in the late afternoon, in about October or November, with the sun sort of slanting and making the marsh grass explode with color. That's just the prettiest sight I can think of at the moment.
And finally, if there was one point or principle you would have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I could be a little bit esoteric and say, you know, we've only got one planet, people. We need to take care of stuff. But what I try to instill in you guys and in my students is that if you really, really want something, you want to be a neurosurgeon, you want to be an astronaut, if you want something badly enough, you're going to get it. You might fail 100 times trying to get it, but if you want it badly enough, you're going to have that career. And I say that with my experience. I wanted to be a marine biologist since I was in my early years of high school. And here I am.
Thank you for joining us. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FishVecchio. The podcast is at FisheriesPod. On Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, always keep trying. He was like, oh, yeah, I was Charlie Winter's first grad student. And I was like, oh, I think I was Charlie Winter's last grad student.
Let me think. Yes, you were.